Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The recent turmoil in Ferguson started as a demonstration against the shooting death of an unarmed black teen by a white police officer. But it also brought to the fore a list of issues that have long been simmering in Ferguson and elsewhere. They include inequality in justice, employment, and governance. A town hall meeting will be held in Ferguson on Thursday, in which these and other issues will be discussed in a conversation moderated by Michelle Martin of NPR. She's the former host of Tell Me More. I'm Don Marsh. Michelle Martin joins us from NPR in Washington to talk about all of these things. With me in studio to contribute to our conversation, journalist Sylvester Brown, executive director and founder of the Sweet Potato Project. That's an effort to teach urban kids skills that will help them develop entrepreneurial talents and help give North St. Louis an economic shot in the arm. Chris Kramer is the president and CEO of Beyond Housing. Its mission is to give service and support to low-income families to help them achieve long-term goals. I thank you all so much for being with us. Michelle, nice to have you on our air again.
Thank you, Don. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'd like to put this same question to each of you to get us started, and I'll start with you, Michelle. What does Ferguson tell us?
Well, that's why I'm coming to find out. I think that people know their own stories best. I often say to people, you are your most important story. And I think my job is to listen and to hear those stories and to make sure that everybody gets a chance to be heard who wishes to be heard, and hopefully heard in a manner that will be constructive to other people listening. Basically, this is neighbors talking to neighbors, and I'm here as a person, as an invite. I've been given the honor of being invited to help facilitate that conversation. So we're going to find out.
All right, let me turn to Chris Kramer. General thoughts about Ferguson and what it tells us.
Well, I think it's a reminder that we have a lot of work to do on so many different fronts. I think one of the challenges of this particular conversation, there are so many different pieces and parts to it, and they're all connected. But the tragedy was a flashpoint. A lot of folks want to focus on that piece. Some folks want to focus on the underlying issues that got us here. So I think for us, it's how do you think about relationships in community? How do you think about what makes up a strong and vibrant community? What are all those component parts? And how do we as a region come together and say we have some challenges that Ferguson opened up wide for us and everyone else to see? And do we have the commitment and the leadership in the region to say, let's see if we begin to tackle those one day at a time, because there's no magic pill here that we're going to take that's going to make things better.
And Sylvester Brown, I know you are still wishing you had a column where you could express your thoughts on a daily basis, but here's your opportunity to tell us what you think.
Well, thank you. I think what Ferguson tells us is that everyone knows the St. Louis region is segregated. We're one of the top five most segregated cities in the country. Ferguson has given us a chance to not only know it, but to see it and to feel it. And it's not just segregated neighborhoods. It's segregated thinking. How the powers that be think. They don't think they need to include African-Americans in development, in job opportunities, in revitalizing, rebuilding communities. That's the issue we need to deal with. How do we think? Why is it that voters vote a certain way? Why is it that business people go to a certain position and don't even think that there's a need for an African-American presence in a city that's 50% black and a county that's 25% black? So it's that issue of segregation.
You know, Michelle, in a sense, we've been down this road before. There have been tragedies that have been similar in the past. And there's always a discussion about having a discussion, which is what you're going to be doing on Thursday. Mm-hmm. But once the event kind of subsides, the conversation stops. How do we keep this one going?
Well, Don, I'm going to throw that to you because you are an important thought leader in your community. So I'm going to put that on you because I think you're going to play a role in that, I hope. But part of it is that people have to have these conversations because they want to have them. And I mean, like Sylvester said, and like Chris also said, that people, you know, they have to recognize that something has occurred, and they may not like it. They may not agree with it. They may be very disgusted by the way in which these issues come to the fore. But once you become aware of something, the decision is on you. Everybody's got a decision about what they're going to do about it. And talking is the one thing we can all do. I think one of the things that we hope to do in our field, and Don, I know you agree with me on this, is show people that you can have these conversations, important ones, difficult ones, painful ones, but you can have them and have them in a way that are constructive. That's going to be, you know, our task going forward. That's going to be our task every day. I also, people have asked me a lot of times, I always think it's funny. I'm sure, Don, you think it's funny too, that as broadcasters, our job is mainly to listen to people. Mm-hmm. But it does happen that occasionally people ask you to talk. And oftentimes people have asked me to talk because the focus of my program over the last 7 years, as you mentioned, Tell Me More. And we were really happy to come to bring the program to St. Louis earlier this year, is people say, well, how do you have those conversations? And one of the things that I like to say to people is the first thing to having an important conversation is to want to have it. Want to have it. And then the second thing is to really listen, especially when you're uncomfortable. And that goes for everybody. I mean, that goes for everybody in the conversation. People need to all be invested in trying to hear what other people have to say, particularly when they disagree with them.
I guess my question is... Go ahead, mm-hmm. Michelle. I'm sorry.
No, and then the third thing I was going to say is that what people kind of do with that has to be... I think you have to start with an assumption of goodwill. I mean, you have to start with the assumption that if you show up and if you're willing to be participatory, then you have an assumption of goodwill.
Yeah, I guess the point to my question, and I'll start with you on this, Michelle, once again, is that, yes, have the conversation, but it has to be sustained. You can't have it and then put it in a bag and in the closet someplace.
Well, that's where leadership comes in, doesn't it? I mean, that's one reason I'm really excited to hear that we are going to have local leadership from Ferguson as a part of our conversation on Thursday, and I'm very excited about that. That's leadership.
I mean, I think, Don, one of the things that I think has been a common chorus in the region is we need some different leadership, some new leadership, some new voices, and particularly from young folks. So I think if this slips into all the same old folks assume they're going to just rise up and I'll help, you know, lead this conversation forward, I will allege this is going to fail. We need additional voices and new voices. I think in the region we're in this interesting space of our new leaders have yet to fully arise, but they're out there. The wisdom and the insightfulness that I've heard over the last 2 weeks or so has been marvelous. And how do we ensure that there are platforms and places and environments for these new voices to rise to help those of us who've been around a few years to give us guidance and thought and allow us to take a deep breath and listen and say, okay, how can I be part of this new conversation?
But Sylvester, I think there's a generational component here, and that is that the young people of today, the ones who are largely out on the streets during the past couple of weeks, they're not really connecting with the old leaders, the mm-hmm. people who heretofore and mm-hmm. traditionally have been the ones to take to get the conversation going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these young people are the ones who have been stopped on the street. They're the ones who've been cursed out by police officers. They're the ones who've been frisked. And, you know, I come at this from a totally different perspective than I had as a journalist. I'm working with youth mm-hmm. from ages 15 to 20. And they tell me the stories. I had a young lady, brilliant young lady, who was stopped on the Metrolink. I mean, I had no idea why this police officer pulled her out and just started asking her questions and accosting her. And I've heard that story over and over and over and over again. And what I've also heard, I mean, I had 25 kids. Of the 25 kids that I've had, 5 of them have had murders in their families this year. So these kids are walking, living, breathing the betrayal that we've put on them. They did not create this condition.
You're saying, and Sylvester, the murders were not by police officers. The murders were
In their families.
But who murdered these people? These were people in the...
These were gang-related or family-related. Murders have an impact, but also the constantly being stopped and searched and harassed and chased and having guns pulled on by police. They merge all that stuff together. So
you're saying they're exposed to a lot of violence, and they're exposed to violence both by people who are kind of in their world, but they're also exposed to violence in the name of the authority, correct?
Yeah, they're exposed to violence, but they're also the reciprocants of whatever happens that they have nothing to do with. You know, if there's gang violence on one part of town, we stop kids because they're black. And they have to live with that and deal with that.
Can I say something about that, though? One of the things that always surprises me, Sylvester, it's interesting, you kind of reinforced this point. You're saying that mm-hmm. what I think I heard you say is that you have a different, even as a reporter, as a columnist, you're out there, because I know, because we work together mm-hmm. on some projects, that mm-hmm. you were out there reporting on issues and really close to people in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But that even now your perspective is different, having worked with these kids one up closely, that you even now you have a different perspective about it. And I think that what that speaks to me is just how little people understand about what other people's day-to-day lives can be. I mean, I find it's interesting to me how indifferent a lot of people are to the indignities experienced by other people in their community. Like, for example, I mean, a lot of us people talk about the fact that it's like, what's your problem? I mean, if you get on an airplane, you know, the TSA is going to ask you questions. They're going through your luggage. Mm-hmm. You have to be screened. But would you, as a middle-class person, find it acceptable if every third time you went through, you know, airport screening, somebody cursed at you?
Exactly.
Or said, put your effing hands up or whatever? Yeah, I mean, exactly. How would you feel about that? And it's just interesting to me that it's almost like we expect these young people to tolerate a level of disrespect that we would never tolerate as adults.
And if I can give you one quick example, and I promise I'll be quick. In class, our kids were talking about how the police confront them. And respect is a really huge thing in their world. You know, you will respect me. So when I saw this kid's body laying on the ground, when I saw the policemen show up with German Shepherds and automatic weapons, right away, the first day, right after it happened, I knew there was going to be trouble. I knew it was going to be trouble. Because there you have a body in the street, a mother screaming for her child, being held back from the child, all the neighbors hearing the shot, seeing the boy in the ground, and the police show up with dogs and machine guns. I said, uh-oh, because I knew the kids in my class would not take that.
Chris Kramer, let me turn to you with regard to this conversation that Sylvester and Michelle have just been having here. Do you think that white people get this? Can they relate to this, the torment that young black men and women go through on a day-to-day basis, such as they've just described?
I mean, look, I think we can never fully understand the context of having the weight of that on your shoulders absolutely each and every day. But what we can do is work really hard at understanding that lived experience, right? And the only way you do that is by having a relationship. Is but being in conversation and being in dialogue, and it's not just one time. It's like, oh yeah, I met with Sylvester's kids that one time, and yeah, I feel better about myself now, right? I went and did that, right? It's really over and over and over again, because then you really truly understand somebody's lived experience. I mean, part of our work and what we're trying to do being in community is to listen to the voice, right? Again, we've heard this thematically, and can we carry it out? Do you really listen to the voice of those who are different than you and those you're trying to work with? Because failure to do so is we'll have nice flowery things, we'll bring in national media folks like Michelle, and we'll have good conversations, but what do you do when the lights go off, right? And what do you do when the attention is down? Our work is 3 yards in a cloud of dust, right? It's showing up every day in community, right? I'm the white guy who's been in these communities for almost 20 years now, right? And the reason why I think we have a little bit of respect for our organization is because guess what? We keep showing up. And we keep listening, and we keep respecting folks, and we listen to their voice and try to carry out the things that they said. These are challenges. These are hopes and aspirations. Would you work with us to try to make those happen? And we've said yes time and time again. And when you do that, right, when you build housing and build grocery stores and do stuff, people say, okay, you know, that organization is listening to me, and I'll share a little bit more, and I'll share a little bit more, and I'll give them more of my thoughts. But that's a long-term play, and as a region, we have to be committed to that. This is a flashpoint now. We're going to have a lot of these conversations, but we have to be committed to the long-term, not sexy, not glamorous, being out in community over and over again.
Can I ask Chris, can I ask you a question? Don, do I have time? Can I ask Chris
a
question?
Yes, I need to take a break, but ask it, and we'll do it after he responds.
Okay. Chris, I wanted to ask, what is it that makes the difference to keeping people engaged? I completely agree with you, by the way, and trust me when I say that I approach this with complete humility as a person who's, you know, coming in to being asked to facilitate a conversation, but recognizing that this conversation is not about me, it's about the people there. When we come back, I'd like to hear more from you about what it takes to keep people engaged in conversations, which can often be difficult for them to have and which bring up things that they don't necessarily want to think about.
Okay. Let's give them a chance to think about that for 1 minute, and we'll come back and continue our conversation. You just heard from Michelle Martin of NPR. She's coming to town this Thursday for a town hall conversation following recent events in Ferguson. With me in studio is Sylvester Brown, journalist, executive director of the Sweet Potato Project, and Chris Kramer, president and CEO of Beyond Housing. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about having a conversation on the situation following the recent turmoil in Ferguson. My guests are Michelle Martin, joining us from NPR in Washington. She's coming to town later this week to have a conversation of her own with community people. And in studio is Sylvester Brown, journalist and executive director of the Sweet Potato Project, and Chris Kramer, president and CEO of Beyond Housing. Chris is poised to answer the question from Michelle, but first, I have to give some news headlines, and here are some of the stories. Our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A new report published by five St. Louis area water utility companies says older water systems and infrastructure in the St. Louis area need to be replaced. The study says utilities should be replacing pipelines about twice as often as they currently do. Missouri law enforcement groups are promoting a proposed constitutional amendment that they say would make it easier to convict child sex offenders. Members of the state prosecutors and sheriff's associations held a news conference today at the Capitol to tout proposed Constitutional Amendment 2 on the November ballot. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has signed a measure into law aimed at curbing workplace discrimination against pregnant women. The plan extends workplace protections to pregnant women, including requiring employers to consider accommodations if asked. That includes limits on manual labor and break space for breastfeeding. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation, and Chris, I'll turn it over to you to respond to Michelle.
Well, Michelle, I think there's no easy answer other than a couple of key pieces that we try to carry out. One is consistency, not just, let's ask you once or twice and then thanks very much. You know, community engagement has now been complete, right? And we'll go do whatever we want. So it's consistency and effort. It's really your respectful approach, right? If you don't come at this and ensure that the way you interact with folks is truly and sincerely respectful of their voice, their opinions, their perspective, then the conversation won't lead to anything. And then lastly, something has to happen. At some point, people understand the value of conversations, but at some point, people want action. And if they don't see tangible things occur, then they're unwilling to keep coming and having a conversation, right? They'll do it for a block of time because it's important. One, they want their voice to be heard, and to be part of change, you have to kind of be in the system in some form or fashion. But at the end of the day, we can't be here, a year later and let's have one more conversation. We're going to meet one more time before we get to, and it doesn't have to be anything large, earth-shattering in terms of what the accomplishment is, but you have to show some action because people are weary and people don't have the emotional energy and time to say, I'm sick and tired of talking to y'all folks. Can we get some work done?
I feel you, Chris, but what I'm actually asking is a different side of the question because the work is about partnership. And what I'm really asking you, and why don't I just go right there. I'm really asking is how you keep the people insulated from the issues engaged. Because if it is a partnership, then presumably you have to have partners across the board. I mean, how do you keep your white neighbors who don't necessarily have these relationships every day? How do you keep your kind of white community partners engaged on something that isn't their problem? I mean, if you have neighbors and friends whose kids are not being stopped by the police or who are not who don't see these issues in their community, who don't have these kinds of friends or don't have relationships, how do you keep them interested? Or is that even a challenge for you? Or do you even feel that that's a part of your mission?
That's precisely the problem.
Yeah, well, so look, a piece of it is you have to compel people to be engaged, right? It can't just simply be, has anybody talked to Chris recently about the problem over there and we'll feel better about ourselves, right? It's how do you compel them to be part of this conversation, recognizing if you weren't paying attention to what's happened in our community over the last 2 weeks and how it doesn't impact all of us, then clearly you're not paying attention. Now, clearly you can shut off quicker than others because it's not in your backyard, all right? Or you look down at the color of your skin and say, I'm going to be okay today when I walk outside, right? You can get past that. But ultimately, it's our collective job to tell everyone you can't walk away from this. I know it's uncomfortable, but you have to be a part of this conversation because it
why do you have to? No, but why do you have to? Well, what's your answer to why? Because let me tell you, one of the things that's been fascinating to me is how many people have said, now I understand that a lot of the support, let me just say, spirit of full disclosure, I come from a police family. I have six police officers in my family, current or former or retired. Okay. So I feel like I can see both sides of the question or all sides of the question. I don't think there is one, even one police point of view on this, just generally, just to be honest with you. But having said that, just given that background, there are a lot of people. You can see that a great deal of money has been raised for Officer Darren Wilson, who mm-hmm. is the key protagonist from the police side in this. And there have been a number of people quoted in media that I followed where people say, I know he did the right thing and he's being made out to be the bad guy. Now, clearly that point of view exists. Right. So and he is innocent. Let's just say from the standpoint of our league, he is innocent of anything until he's proven guilty in a court of law by a jury of his peers. And that process has not yet occurred. So that is, in fact, true. But just from the standpoint of people who say that this is just, you know, that this kid was wrong and that this shouldn't have happened and it's a shame, but I see no further need for any further conversation from that. What do you say?
Well, I think we get back to, you know, Sylvester's point from earlier about the consistent challenges that folks in our community face day in and day out, right? It's not an isolated case where there could have been, you know, a challenge between law enforcement and young African-American kids in our community. It happens each and every day. And if we're not willing to say, let me hear the voices of others, that I am fortunate because we allow ourselves to be segregated from each other, right? I can live my life and occasionally hear about that and then go back to my normal life. How do we compel people to say, listen to the voice of these young people, these young, talented people who want nothing different than our children want, right? They have aspirations and dreams. And if you fail to listen to them, then you're shortchanging the value that you could bring to this conversation, the different perspectives that you could bring. So everybody understands each other's, again, lived experience. And we have to force ourselves to do that. It's going to be real easy not to, right? Go back to your life, right? I don't live in Ferguson. I'm not around there. It doesn't really impact me, kind of. I can go back to my life.
Let me just bring this into the conversation, and Sylvester, I'll direct this at you. I heard something on NPR this morning saying that nothing really is going to happen through discussion. It's only going to happen through policy changes, through public policy changes. One of the things that's going on in Ferguson to some degree is the fact they're distributing voter registration cards. They're trying to get these young people involved so that they can elect people who will be responsive to their needs and their ambitions and create policy changes that will hopefully prevent this sort of thing. It seems to me that's the way to go. What do you think?
You know, we have an African-American president, who cannot specifically talk about the disproportionate woes of African-Americans because he will be labeled a racist. I'm not convinced that policy change, politics, politicians is a solution here. We got to think totally different. It's not about, I mean, social media has a wonderful power to bring attention to stuff. It also has the power to exaggerate and amplify stereotypes and biases.
Inflame.
You look on TV and you see black folks rioting. A lot of white people are saying, oh, don't bring that to my neighborhood. And that's where they stop. We need to have a conversation that makes everything equal. And I know this sounds kind of flowery. White people understand that they need businesses in their jobs. They understand they want quality schools. They want safe neighborhoods. They want the opportunity to make money. Same thing African-Americans want. What we have to start talking about is how do we empower African-Americans to do for themselves? Government answer is gone. Entitlement answer is gone. We've got to start creating communities that were pre-civil rights legislation. After that, we decided to leave our communities, the best jobs, the black families. We followed the busing. We left our communities. We left these communities to become what they are now. We got to turn that back around.
Sylvester, are you saying, though, that you don't feel there's a need for a cross-community conversation? You feel like this is an internal conversation within the African-American community? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that we need to change the topic of the conversation. It's not about what whites can do to make this better. It's what it's really about, how can whites help African-Americans become self-sustainable? How can we put these communities back in our own control? And Michelle, you know this. When we were kids, many of these neighborhoods, we knew the teachers. They lived in the neighborhoods. We knew the bakers. We knew the pawn shop owner. They knew us, and they could say, I'm going to tell Ms. Brown what you're doing. We lost that part of our community. So what we need to focus on, and you come to St. Louis, you'll see lots and lots of beautiful development in the Grand Center and all over. We got to find a way to bring that kind of mindset, that kind of development to these communities. How can we get these brilliant, young, sharp, resilient young African-American kids who are doing amazing work with videos. And I've heard 7 Mike Brown songs that were all very, very good that they've come up with in a few days. These kids are brilliant. They have ideas. They have dreams. They have wishes. We got to put them to work in rebuilding their own communities.
But why doesn't policy play a role in that? I mean, the fact is business people often talk about removing the obstacles to success for them. Why isn't the same thing true with a lot of these young people? I mean, some of the reporting that's been really interesting to me in recent weeks as I've been, you know, following this is about the degree to which that fees and fines are funding municipal government, and fees and fines, which disproportionately affect certain people.
Exactly.
And I just think that's a policy, you know, issue. You know, I understand that, you know, there's like, let me bring back to the kind of the Washington, D.C. example, is that there are a number of municipalities that now that are funding their probation systems privately, which means that they impose fees mm-hmm. for things like for functions of government, like, you know, making, you know, monitoring systems. And if you don't pay those fees, you're then arrested. That's exactly. A policy issue. And then you're even further in the hole. Those are policy issues that create, well, some people, and obviously there's two sides to that question. People say, well, you know, fees and fines are less punitive, you know, than locking people up, unless people get locked up for not paying those fees and fines. But other people say, well, really what you're doing is you're using the poorest segments of the population to fund your municipal services.
Exactly.
And there's an issue there. That's mm-hmm. policy. And why can't those things both be? Why can't both things happen? Why can't both conversations take place?
I think both things must happen. But it's chicken and egg. Which comes first, politics or economics? Ledoux, Clayton, Chesterfield, any other white enclave would not stand for that. You know why they would be listened to is because they build the system. Their tax dollars, the money that they make, it runs the system. So they have the clout, the economic clout, to say, you will not do this in my community. I believe that we need to start building economic clout in our communities. If there's enough people with jobs and money and houses in the city of St. Louis, in Ferguson, they would gather together to protect what's theirs. Those kids out in Ferguson, those black families out in Ferguson right now, they don't really see Ferguson as their city, as their neighborhood. So we have to find a way to get them invested first. And I hear the politicians saying, go register to vote. But what's that going to do? What have you done for me? I mean, we have a black county executive out there in St. Louis County. We have, you know, black aldermen here in St. Louis. You're saying I'm going to vote for what? You're not showing me anything that benefits me, right, that takes care of my immediate needs right now. I'm still in poverty. I'm still living in
the piece that follows, you know, the after you cast your ballot is then holding folks accountable. Right at the end of the day, okay. Now you've told me you care about me, and you're going to follow up on my interest. And that, if that does not happen, then there are consequences to that. Right? Again, where is
it's
it?
A long range.
That's a long range accountability structure, right? That says, okay, a piece of it, and I agree with Michelle's kind of it's not the either or, it's the and both, right? So again, a piece of that then becomes how do we hold folks in positions of power accountable, and what does that look like, and what does that longer conversation look like, and look, anytime you offer someone a chance to have some power over their life, they want a piece of that, right? And they want to understand.
Maintain it and
correct,
hang on to
correct,
it.
Correct, correct. How and again, can we give folks the tools and the information and the resources to say we want to help you get power and then maintain power over time?
Let's expand our conversation if we can, bring some of our listeners into it. We want to get as many voices heard as we can during the time that remains, and we'll start with Debbie. She's calling from Belleville. It's not exactly Ferguson or in our backyard, but it's close enough, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. I just have a point. I'm not trying to take it away from the black focus at all. I'm white, do a lot of work within the East St. Louis and Cahokia communities, which there's so much racial charge. I was raised in a very white community. I was raised with all the fears of the black, and I've lost so many friends over this Ferguson because I've sided with the fact that the injustices are outrageous. And I keep telling people to stop starting the sentences with "they are," because until we start talking about this, it's going to continue.
Debbie, can you stay on? Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for calling, and I appreciate your willingness to risk something, you know, to have a conversation. Because, you know, it's harder to have conversations with our friends, isn't it? Than it is with people who are already mad at us. Like, you know, if I get a letter from somebody, which I get like all the time, some unsigned letter from somebody that I don't know, you know, telling me where to go, I'm like, okay, whatever. But if it's somebody that I know and somebody that I otherwise respect, telling me that I need to think about things differently, then that causes me to think differently. So I appreciate your being willing to risk something with your friends to have these conversations. But can I ask a little bit more about what they're feeling? What are they saying? Is it that they how are they reacting to all these events, these friends that you're talking about?
Well, they just think that this poor police officer has been sidewinded and that everybody is going against them and that all those crazy people were out rioting and they're getting what they deserved. And if he wouldn't have done what he did, then none of this would have happened. And they will not understand the fact that it's a part of a bigger issue. It's not, as much as it is about Mike Brown, it's not about him. It's about the oppression that's happened for so long. This was the perfect storm, and I don't know why it happened as it did, but it was a perfect storm.
And before we let you go, can I just ask one more question of you, which is, what is it in your experience that causes you to see it differently? Is there some story you could tell us about why you feel like you have such a different reaction to it than so many of your friends?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Caseyville, which became a community after all the white flight out of East St. Louis. And all of my neighbors when I was growing up told me horror stories about blacks. That's not the word that was used. I was raised knowing where the lynching trees were. I was raised with the signs telling people where they couldn't go past 5 o'clock at night. And then I got into violence prevention. My specialty is domestic violence prevention. And I started going to the community and I started realizing that they were just the same as me. And the same fears times 10. And I learned to listen and I learned to talk about it. And people tell me all the time, you're going to get shot going down there. And I tell people all the time, I'm not the person that gets shot. It's the guys that are throwing dice. It's the drug deals gone bad. It's the family stuff. They're not after me. And I've never felt threatened. Never.
You know, I think you know, Debbie, again, has really touched on this notion that, white folks just struggle to understand. They just feel like, okay, somebody else's life story must be just like mine, so I wouldn't have done that. So if I wouldn't have done that, then why on earth would anybody else? And that's just not understanding, right? And not taking a moment to say, you know, I don't know anything about Michael Brown or fill in the blank, right? I don't know anything about you, so I cannot make any assumptions about, again, how you think, what you've been through, how you react to stuff. I think that we just feed into so many preconceived narratives that until we start turning that narrative and talking to each other, it is never going to get away from, unfortunately, Debbie and many others losing friends potentially over something like this.
But we need more Debbies to take this on. I mean, no question about that. I have to take a break. Sylvester, hold your thought. We'll come back and pick it up in just a moment. We're having a conversation about the conversations that folks should be having following the recent turmoil in Ferguson. My guest, Michelle Martin, she joins us from NPR in Washington. Sylvester Brown is in studio, as is Chris Cranemeyer, from whom you've just heard. Back to continue the discussion and take more of your calls in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Michelle Martin, Sylvester Brown, and Chris Cranemeyer. I'm going to go right to the phones. We'll bring in Keith, who has been waiting. He's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Keith.
Hello. Yeah, I was just wanting to share a few comments. And, you know, it's just to be frank, when there is an advantaged or an advantaged society that has privilege, it's hard to get them to experience the black experience. But they can experience the human experience. So anytime somebody's done wrong or treated unjustly, there should be a relationship there. It shouldn't always be a black-white issue. So if I'm sitting at home and, you know, I know what's right and I know what's wrong, and I see a young man that gets gunned down and he's unarmed, my first inclination should be to say, hey, you know, something is wrong. Let me stand up and see what's wrong. But what happens is, for some reason, you know, the white population says if it's a black person, then you know what? They probably got what they deserve. And so the dynamic of black-white always prevails, or seems to always prevail, in the Midwest instead of what's right. You know, what's just, because everybody wants justice. Everybody wants fair treatment. But there's always these ideas about, well, this person probably deserved it. So when we look at policy and we look at behavior, they go hand in hand, you know, because there's an opportunity where policy can help people create discussions, but the behavior and experience are the only ways that people will actually get an opportunity to have those human experiences with each other. And when those things don't happen, I don't care, you know, what municipality you're in, I don't care what region you're in, when there's a complete polarization of society, if it's economic, socioeconomic, if it's, you know, just geographically, if there's division, there's always going to be tremendous challenges to bridge that gap. And so I just wanted to share that, not that it's anything that's, you know, revolutionary or even revelational. It's just the fact that when there's an advantage in society, it's almost impossible.
Michelle is chomping at the bit to respond.
I just wanted to ask, is it Keith?
Keith.
Sir? It's Keith. Can I just ask you, how do you keep that open-mindedness in your own life? How do you keep from falling into that trap in your own life?
Well, you know, it's extremely difficult because even during this circumstance, you know, I had colleagues that I used to work with that are, well, I'm African American. I'm sure you probably tell by the heaviness of my voice. And
no, I can't. No. I know that is a very interesting observation. But
no, we can talk about that another time. But yeah, I'm African American. So you know, I've been contacted by colleagues I used to work with, and the reality of it is no matter how well-informed they are, how emotional intelligent they think they are, there's often some opportunities where they just can't relate. So, you know, I've gotten, you know, out of the habit of trying to persuade people to think how I think and to see things how I see. I just try to make it, you know, a paradigm switch. Put yourself in those shoes. If your child was shot by a police officer and, you know, that officer shot your child 6 to 8 times, and you don't see a weapon, and there's some confusion, but there are a few witnesses, what would you think? And even when you propose a direct question or a scenario like that, it's still a tremendous challenge for some of those white colleagues to even see it, because they have that flexibility to turn on the privilege, the advantage. And some of them actually are completely blinded by it, and some of them choose not to see it. But the reality of it is, and the evidence of it is, you have a component of people that clearly has sided with the officer. And regardless of what evidence comes out, they're going to side with the officer because in their mind they've been, you know, planted a seed that this young African-American male probably has something to do with his own demise. And if you just look at the facts, or if you just look at what's been revealed right now, in most cases you'll be inclined to say, you know what, it's probability that this officer overreacted. But even with what you know now, there's still so many people that are inclined to believe and support the officer. So there's just
He does have the right to the presumption of innocence. That is just true. From the legal standpoint, he has the right to the presumption of innocence, as everyone does. And if the situation were reversed, I would hope that people would offer the presumption of innocence to either party in such an occasion. Can I just ask you one more question, Keith, before you let you?
I'm sorry, go ahead. I
just wanted to ask you one more question. Do you feel at least encouraged that you have these colleagues who are at least asking your opinion? Does that open any door for you, that at least people are interested in what you have to say?
Actually, no. I'm more discouraged because these are people that actually know right from wrong. And these are people. So if this was a unique situation and, you know, we say, oh, this is an odd happening, but we can show example after example after example where this is happening. And so that, to me, it's more discouraging, you know. That's it.
Well, thank you for calling. I'm sad we had to hear from you. Don, well, I don't mean to presume. I'm just appreciative of these perspectives. It's very helpful.
Absolutely. Well, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing, is getting these perspectives and collecting them and then deal with what we learn, correct? Let's bring in Dana, who is calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Dana.
Hi, Don. Hi, Michelle. Keith and Sylvester. I know Keith and Sylvester well. I appreciate what they do in the community. I know how difficult it is. But one of the things that I noticed is that, or not noticed, but Charles Jayco tweeted that Emerson was directly across the street from the happenings of what happened with Mike Brown, and that Express Scripts was less than a mile away, and some of these largest employers, and he started going on about the largest employers in St. Louis, and it was my thought that Michael Brown could probably not have gotten a job cleaning toilets at any of these places. And we need to look at the employment opportunities that are provided these lower-skilled and non-skilled labor. There is not enough employment. Not enough employment opportunities for these young men out there. And so no matter how, I love what Sylvester's doing in trying to create entrepreneurial opportunities, but, you know, even businesses in St. Louis that have been in business, employing black businesses that have been in businesses in St. Louis, they're not employing the numbers. They're not employing all those people. We don't have enough jobs out here.
Dana, thanks for the call. We have the point, but we're running out of time. And I don't think anybody as part of this group here disputes the fact that jobs are a critical element in this whole process. Dana, thanks for your call. Now let's bring in Edie calling from Overland. Edie, go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. And this may seem a naive solution, but I am a 66-year-old white woman who uses public transportation exclusively. And I would like to ask the white community to get out of their cars and try using public transportation. It is the great equalizer. My experiences have been positive. All those young black men that people are afraid of allow me on the bus first. They will get up to give me a seat on the bus or Metrolink. They are incredibly respectful. And if the white population would get out of their cars, we might have a chance at changing the dynamic.
Edie, thank you so much for the call. Anyone want to react to that?
I think Edie kind of hits the point. That is getting folks interacting together. And but it has to be done for a reason. And again, we have to find a way to be very creative, use this new agricultural movement, use the solar energy movement. We have to find a way to get these kids working. If I was in Ferguson right now, I'd initiate a bill backed by the businesses in that community to have those young kids rebuilding the stores that were torn down. The owners would get to know them. They become a part of the mainstream. And when you get to poverty and how whites were able to come out of gangs and come out of violence, they were allowed to come into the economic mainstream. We've got to get creative about finding a way to empower people in their own communities.
Let's take another call. Unless Michelle or Chris have something to add to that, we'll move along. And we'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, go ahead.
Good morning. The first thing I'd like to say, Michelle, is I greatly, terribly miss your show.
Second of all,
the show that you're on has done so much for years now to really illuminate the history of the racial situation in the St. Louis area. I grew up in the very neighborhood that served as the backdrop to the rioting, and I'm closing in on 60 years old, and I think it's really, and I'm gradually seeing more of it in the news media, but this is the culmination of trends that have been going on for decades. And they have to do with race relations. I spent a weekend in New York, and you know, it's a melting mixing pot, and people are just people. But as people have said, this is kind of a racially segregated city. And I also think the neighborhood I grew up in right there were filled with people who were relatively unskilled, high school diplomas maybe, but they had good jobs working for generally Chevrolet, the Ford plant, or McDonnell Aircraft. And that segment of our society, that part of America, has essentially gone away, where a person can go into a blue-collar job, raise a family, have a pension, et cetera. And I think that also plays into it. So it's a very complicated situation, and I really appreciate the thoughtful coverage we've had just in the past couple of weeks on this show and on NPR in general. I think it's the only voice of sanity so far.
Mm. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah, Jerry, thank you for the call. We appreciate that, and thanks for making those points. Let's bring in Scott. He's calling from Southern Texas. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me on. First-time caller. I just wanted to call and say that I'm a white male myself, and I actually do feel like I can relate to some of the police harassment that kind of surrounds some of the topics today. I grew up in Oakville, Missouri, of course, and have several circumstances where I was stopped or pulled over by police and harassed as a teenager, and a lot of my friends were as well, and simply because of the fact that we were teenagers. And in that area, of course, there's not a lot of violent crime or any other crime for that matter. So, ones in that community that were committing the crimes and, albeit, smashing mailboxes and things like that, were teenagers. That's what they were dealing with at that point. I think where the disconnect comes in is that we view it as something that happens in our youth, but that does not transfer over into our adult lives. So I think that's where that disconnect comes in. And, you know, as adults, you know, we don't have any stories of being followed by police for walking in a nice neighborhood or, you know, being followed by security at a department store or something like that. But I think it can be relatable, but we see it as something that we can kind of grow out of.
Scott, thanks for the call. Michelle, do you want to respond to him? Or,
no, it's interesting. Yeah. I think he's making some really important points. I mean, the last couple of callers have made some interesting points. And I just also think maybe one of the things I can say to be helpful here is that having covered a lot of these stories, not just in the United States, but also elsewhere in the world, a lot of people are dealing with these issues. So people, it's painful as it is, they shouldn't feel alone in this. There's recently a study that was published, a 25-year study of employment patterns in Baltimore, following a very large group of kids, both equally divided between white and black. And one of the things they realized is that less educated white kids growing up in that community with the same education levels as the black kids were far more likely to be employed at those the kinds of jobs that I think the earlier caller, Dana, was talking about. And why is that? Because of their networks. These were invisible to them. Their friends had a job, their fathers had a job, their cousins had a job, and they used those relationship networks to get employment despite their lack of education. They even had run-ins with law enforcement, but somehow it didn't affect their employment prospects in the same way that it did for black kids in the same communities with the same kinds of profiles. So that's something to consider. And then the other, the call that we just had where one young the guy said that his experience was that some people say they've had this experience, but it's something that they grow out of. That's really worth considering when you're thinking about this whole question of empathy. I mean, the other data point that I want to throw out there is that there's been some interesting research recently that shows that black boys in particular and Latino boys to a slightly lesser extent are far more likely to be viewed as older than they are. Mm. And that's something that I think is worth considering. So I think that in the midst of all this kind of pain and grief, I think it's important to focus on the fact that there's a lot of good work going out on that kind of helps people understand the world a little better if people are willing to learn those things. And what I'm hearing today is that even though a lot of people feel that those conversations come with a cost, people are having them. I think that's worth noting.
I'd like to bring in one more caller because it's coming from Ferguson, and it's Andrea. Let's see what she has to say. Go ahead, Andrea.
Hi, my name is Andrea, and I live in Ferguson. And, you know, I kind of felt offended by the gentleman, Keith, that called in that said that none of us that are white can understand that this was a tragedy. And I have a young black grandson, and I also have a young black granddaughter. And I feel that us in Ferguson, I know there's a two-block radius, but a lot of us are diversified. And we're just being painted in this corner like we just can't understand anything. And I feel that that's a
tragedy. How old are your grands? Can I ask you that? Thank you for calling. How old are your kids? How old are the grands?
My granddaughter is 16 and my grandson is 8.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we have had the conversation and he is biracial. But, you know, I tell him, behave yourself. And so does his mother. And I don't know what the future will bring and I hope things do change. But I don't understand why this gentleman thinks that no white people can understand that just was just a tragedy. And it is.
Andrea, thank you for the call. Time is getting away. Who wants to respond to her situation here?
It's just a reminder that don't make assumptions. I mean, it's so easy to go knee-jerk reactions. Just take a moment and recognize them. Everybody, life is different, and we can't assume things about others. We do that so frequent because it's simple and easy to do, and just see if we can stop and get away from that and actually have relationships with others.
We only have go ahead, Michelle.
Well, do you mind if I throw out very briefly?
I know
that Trayvon Martin is a name that a lot of people will know. There was an identical but a similar tragedy. And one of the more powerful conversations I had was a speaking engagement I had in upstate New York with I walked into a room that looked to be a room full of predominantly white people, and a number of people came up to me and said, just like this lady just said, I have a black grandson, I have a black boy in my life, and I am as heartbroken as you are. And I am very glad that she called, because I think that's important to remember that, you know, all relationships are not immediately visible, but that's something we all need to think about, isn't it?
It surely is. I wish we had more time. There is so much to talk about. I've heard a lot of people suggest that this point in our history may be representative of a new chapter in civil rights. That's a huge question. I don't think we can answer it in any amount of time here, but maybe it will be, and let's hope that it is and that something good comes out of this Ferguson process. Thank you all so much for being with us. Michelle, look forward to seeing you on Thursday.
Thank you. Thank you so much for
having us. Town Hall meeting Thursday from 6 to 8 at Wellspring Church on South Florissant in Ferguson. It's free and open to the public. Chris Kramer, thank you for being with us once again. Sylvester Brown, it's always a pleasure to see
you. Thank you,
Don. Keep up the good work with your Sweet Potato Project.
Thank you, sir.
That's it for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with StoryCorps founder David Isay. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.